WFAE is proud to launch a new investigative podcast called She Says, which looks at one sexual assault survivor's efforts to bring her assailant to justice. Find out more at WFAE.org/She Says.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The Panthers have a new owner. David Tepper signs the deal, and the other owners meet next week to seal it or reject it. Teachers descend on Raleigh for students, money, and respect, and the Poor People's Campaign arrives there as well. Charlotte City Council's Luana Mayfield is back in the news with more controversial comments. The Charlotte Symphony's Christopher Warren Green conducts the royal wedding, and we settle it. Or at least explain the internet meme, Laurel or Yanni. It cannot be Yanni. He went out in the 80s, for crying out loud. Our roundtable reporter has details on those and other stories this hour. David Borax is here from WFAE News. Good morning. Welcome back.
Hello, Mike.
Jim Morrill is back. He's from the Charlotte Observer, where he's a political reporter. Hello, hello.
Hello, Mike.
Mary C. Curtis, columnist for Roll Call and contributor to WCCB-TV. Welcome to you.
Good morning.
And Sean Flynn is managing editor at Spectrum News Charlotte. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike. Good morning, everyone.
You can get to us through all the easy ways, and also you can watch us on Facebook Live. It became official this week. Of course, the Panthers have a new owner, or they probably will have a new owner. That would be David Tepper, the billionaire hedge fund manager. He signed the deal. Now it goes to the NFL in Atlanta for their meeting next week of all the owners for their imprimatur. Is this just a pro forma, a rubber stamp? Is he the guy?
I think he is a guy. I think he's well known to NFL owners. He's part owner of the Pittsburgh Steelers, so he's already been vetted by the NFL, and he came up with the cash. And so I think it's a pro forma thing.
So he's been vetted by the NFL because he's already a partial owner. So why does he have to go through any process whatsoever? Why don't they just say, okay, Jerry wants to sell it to you. You got it? Have at it.
I think that's pretty much what's going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's the big club over there, and they all have to have their say in every little bit of every single team.
And one would presume that he knows these guys. He certainly knows the owner of the Steelers, so, I mean, and he's got the Steelers owner's vote, right?
Right.
But he'd have to give up his share in that
right. If
he wants the big prize. And everyone in Charlotte just wants to know, please stay in Charlotte.
What you said, Sean, it's a club. He's already in it.
Yes, absolutely.
So what else do we know about this guy? He's a billionaire. He has a hedge fund. He moved it from his hometown to Miami. He's a partial owner of the Steelers. What else do we know about him?
Well, he's outspoken politically. He said some things about the president that probably wouldn't go over too well with a lot of season ticket holders here. But
you mean that the comment about him being a demented, narcissistic scumbag?
That's the very one.
Comments like that.
He proudly told students at Carnegie Mellon, which is where he went to school, that the president is a demented, narcissistic scumbag. And he said to them, if you Google those words, demented, narcissistic scumbag, my name will come up. I checked. It did.
Yeah. He's also very much has a reputation as a philanthropist, which would play better in Charlotte.
There's also been some stories that have popped up of him as a highly aggressive hedge fund manager and being very aggressive in the office.
Meaning?
He's a bit of a screamer.
Okay, all right.
But this goes back years when he was making his billions to buy the team.
Okay. John Vrooman, who I do not know, but he's a sports columnist with Vanderbilt University. Or sports economist with Vanderbilt University, says he will be more fan-friendly and more accessible. And in terms of the overall Panthers fan experience, this should be a positive-sum move. Of course, that will be positive in that way unless he decides to move the team or wants to build a new stadium. Then we might get into some strange and negative territory.
Yeah, I'd be surprised if he says anything, at least early on, about either one of those things, about moving the team especially. So far, I think what he said is that the Carolinas is a good fit.
Yeah.
Charlotte is a good place for a team. And if he decides to move it someplace else, that would probably be down the road.
He's also, it's in the honeymoon phase. He's even talking about getting local folks in as minority partners in these. So he's making really nice right now.
From a business standpoint, this is a business after all. There's lots of talk about the Panthers having a lot of I don't know, in business world, you might call it upside. A lot of things that they can do to manage the business better, to squeeze some more money out of it. One of the things that's been mentioned is the fact that the Panthers don't control the parking around the stadium. You know, if we have an aggressive business owner coming here to do this, I would expect to see him get aggressive with some of these things and look for some deals that would help fill some of those gaps.
He's buying this team at a record price, $2.275 billion, with $2.2 billion of cash up front.
That's all the cash he had.
That's just walking around pocket change, right? And he's doing this at a time when the people are concerned about the future of football in America because of all the concussion news and because of declining TV ratings. That's their big source of revenue, the TV revenue that comes in. Does he know something about football that the rest of us don't know? Or is it just as an example of his being an aggressive, risk-taking investor?
I think it's he's a bit aggressive, so he's going to go after it. I think he also wants to be part of that club that we talked about previously, being one of the 32. The other thing is, even though you've had those declining ratings, the NFL keeps making more and more and more money. Even this week with the Supreme Court decision on sports betting, I bet you that the NFL will somehow find a way to cash in on that. So I even heard one former vice president of the Green Bay Packers who said David Tepper signed the deal on Monday, and by Tuesday after that Supreme Court decision, he's already made a ton of money on the deal.
Yeah.
So this league will continue to find money and ways to make money until something significant happens to change that direction.
We'll be talking about this in depth.
And we'll have to get into the nitty-gritty, too, when they start asking the city to pony up money for the upgrades and all of that.
We'll be talking about this in depth on Tuesday. But why did the Panthers grab this record price? How were we able to get that kind of money when I think the last time a team was sold was it Buffalo?
Buffalo Bills in 2014 sold for, I think, $1.5 billion.
Wow.
You know, that's 4 years ago. I think prices have gone up. I think there's also a difference between Buffalo and Charlotte as markets and
absolutely
the stadium that they had versus what we have here. So I think this team is actually worth more. So I don't think it's a surprise that it went for that amount.
Yeah, there's only 32 teams, and they're not making new ones.
Right.
So,
well, they might.
You know, I offered $2.5 billion, but they didn't take it.
Okay, well, you're cheapskate.
I wasn't vetted.
You didn't use enough of your TV money. I think it was Mary that mentioned that he wants to get some local investors involved. We have local minority owners in the team right now. How many of them do we know will try to get into the minority ownership of this ownership group versus cashing out and taking their money and having a good time with it, because they're going to make a lot?
Well, several of them I've already expressed interest, because it is, as we have said, a club. It's prestigious. And, you know, it is good for business if you're in Charlotte or in the Carolinas. So I think he wouldn't have any problem there.
Meanwhile, the city of Charlotte has been quietly setting aside money, evidently. $75 million for a second round of renovations for Bank of America Stadium. Would this have happened had Jerry Richardson remained owner of the team?
Yeah, I think it probably would have. You know, I think they realize that they have to invest something sooner or later, just like they did a few years ago when it was, what, $80 million or something for...
Do we even know what the $75 million would be earmarked for?
What kind of renovations?
Is it just there as a slush fund?
This has been in the works since before the whole Richardson scandal broke. They've been looking at this day coming when they would have to do this. I think the Panthers are committed here until 2019. They know that that is their deadline for getting some more money together to do whatever needs to be done next.
And if you think about last summer when there was all the talk about the MLS team and all the members of the city council are like, well, hey, yeah, that would be great, but we still got to pay a lot more money to keep the Panthers here, so let's put the soccer on the back burner.
What, if anything, has David Tepper said about the stadium?
That's pretty much what he said about it so far.
Nothing at all. Okay. So, and the city, meanwhile, has also been talking about the need for $50 million for affordable housing, which it will raise through a bond referendum, which taxpayers will pay for ultimately. But the $75 million is going to come from the city motel
hospitality tax.
Was it 3% on hotel and motel rooms in Mecklenburg County, 1% on restaurants and bar tabs here? So we will most likely be paying the 1%. If you eat out or have a beer or a glass of wine someplace, you're paying that. But the bulk of it's coming from visitors. Correct?
Yeah, people who stay in hotels here.
Does that soften the blow for taxpayers and citizens here who might think, I don't want to give $75 million to a billionaire?
No. I don't think it does. I think people see tax money, billionaire. I think they make the connection, and they don't. A lot of them don't like it.
Okay.
Fascinating editorial in The Observer, I think, in the past couple of days, looking at how we've got this guy who's worth, what, $8 billion. He's paying $2.2 billion for the team, and he's going to come to the city and ask for money. And actually, The Observer's editorial was making an argument for why he would do that.
Mm. Yes, I think was it this morning or yesterday? It was in the paper. You need to take the paper, read these editorials. All right, moving on. On Wednesday, thousands of teachers from around the state descended on the legislature on the opening day of the short session. They were chanting Red for Ed, the hashtag for the teachers' movement, and most of them wore red T-shirts. They added a political chant to their repertoire as well. So, I think David and you, Jim, were both in Raleigh for this rally. How many teachers showed up?
Well, there were officially about 19,000, I think. It was pretty incredible, really.
It's bigger than projections.
In the rain.
Yeah.
In the rain with umbrellas.
We're anticipating 10 to 15, and you're getting 19,000 people.
19,000 who had to go through the new security screeners in the legislature to get into the building.
Well, 19,000 people were not in the legislature. But there were definitely hundreds there, and there was a long line waiting to get in and talk to the legislators.
Yeah. They called this a march for students and a rally for respect. It was the largest act of organized teacher political action in the history of North Carolina. And yet I read in The Observer this morning one of the teachers who was there saying something along the lines of the legislators did their best to get into the building as quickly as possible and avoid us at all costs. Did it have any impact?
You know, I don't know if it had any impact. I think it had impact on the teachers, and certainly there were some legislators who were sympathetic to their views. I think the teachers were, for their part, were energized. It felt a lot like the Women's March, sort of the same energy, a lot of signs coming up. But I don't think that the legislators, Republican legislators who control the General Assembly, are going to do a lot because of this march.
I talked to one guy there who said, we feel like we had a great show of strength today. And he was from an elementary school teacher from Union County. And I heard that from other people as well. I think for teachers, they do feel like they have come together and they have a movement here. I think a lot of them were talking about we're going to vote in November. And we have yet to see whether that will translate into any kind of a movement and affect the outcome of the election. But I do think that movement came together. Within the halls of the State House the other day, I did see a lot of people meeting with legislators, both Republican and Democrat. The conversations seemed to be polite, but I heard a lot of teachers, you know, spouting facts about what they make and all that sort of thing. And I think that was really important.
And some of those teachers found their way into the Senate chamber. They filled the gallery of the chamber. And that little disruption there caused them to be escorted out. Was that the only incidence of disruption of business in the legislation?
I think that was the only thing that I heard about. I heard somebody describe it as shutting it down. I think that was an inaccurate portrayal of it. I think the Senate, you know, wrapped up their business as expected. And other than that, it was really just the meetings in the hallways that were affecting the day for those legislators.
You know, in the afternoon, there were legislators who met outside in the rain with some of their constituents.
And we'll talk a little bit more about this, because 19,000 people is a significant number of people. We'll talk about the impact of their visit to Raleigh when we come back on the other side of the break on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I think I'm 30 seconds early. That's never happened before. So before we go away, did that disruption have any negative impact in 20 seconds or less?
No negative impact. Will it have an effect? I think that's the question.
Okay. David Borax from WFAE News, Jim Morrow from The Observer, Sean Flynn from Spectrum News, and Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call, all with us this morning on the local news roundup. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Giant trash piles, missing cankerworms, subway station entrances that lead to nowhere. Which listener-submitted topic do you want us to report on for our next FAQ City podcast? Cast your vote and contribute your own question right now at wfae.org/FAQ City. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about teachers right now in this portion of the Charlotte Local News Roundup with David Borax from WFAE News, Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call, WCCB-TV, Sean Flynn from Spectrum News, and Jim Morrill from the Charlotte Observer. On the eve of this teachers' march on Wednesday, in which 19,000 teachers from around the state, I think, what, three dozen school systems shut down for the day so the teachers could go home?
Maybe 42, I think.
Okay. On the eve of that march, Erlene Lyde, who's the head of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Association of Educators, told us on this program that this march was about more than just teacher pay.
Each year, they have been asked to do more with less because they keep reducing the amount of funds, per pupil expenditure, and we see what is happening to kids when we don't have enough teacher assistants, when we don't have enough resources, and we're really worried about our poorer counties that don't have the local supplements that can help retain teachers, and so we're losing.
But on that same program, Representative Craig Horn, who represents Union County and is chair of the House Education Appropriations Committee, pushed back on the narrative that the GOP-controlled legislature has not been pro-teacher.
We've invested more than $2 billion with a B, new dollars in education. We have added nearly $1 billion in cash in teachers' pockets. Now, that doesn't mean that we've done all the we've just been great people. We're still behind, and we're way behind, and we need to continue to raise teacher pay and improve benefits, but we also need to particularly focus on student outcomes.
He's not the only Republican who has said something similar to that and who have touted the accomplishments of the Republican legislature with regard to teachers and how they've increased education funding and teacher pay 2 years in a row and are planning to give teachers an average 6.2% raise, the fifth straight raise in a row. Somehow they came up with that figure. Teachers say they're still earning less than they were before the Great Recession when you adjust their pay for inflation. So, is the legislature digging in because it's Republican-controlled, or do you think they were open to hearing the teachers' point of view? Do you think when the teachers came and gave their salary figures and talked about their plight of supplying their own supplies, et cetera, in the classroom, that legislators heard it?
You know, I think some did. I think some, though, were probably talking past each other. I mean, people like Craig Horn are sincere advocates mm-hmm. of education. And Republicans were touting some of the things that you mentioned, the consecutive pay raises and the boost in education spending. But for teachers, you know, these are still people who are sometimes working more than one job, who can't afford to live. I talked to some of them the other day up there, a young teacher who's been here 3 years and can't afford to live here anymore, really.
And when he was on the program earlier this week, Craig Horn said that he has spent some time in the classroom, and he thinks that every legislator should spend time in a teacher's classroom. They would be amazed at what they have to put up with, how hard they have to work, what they have to do outside of just being in front of the classroom. And he said, I don't see how they do it. And yet, we are where we are. And he's the head of the House Committee on Education.
I was funny when you were talking that they can't live. One of the favorite signs I was watching the coverage was, my second job paid for this sign. But I do think that even though they were talking past one another, it's fascinating that they aren't demonizing them, because teachers are very sympathetic. And we all can remember our favorite teacher, and a lot of people have children in the schools, and they see how hard the teachers work.
And if you look at national surveys, parents are supporting teachers
yes.
in this movement. So it's they're voters.
Yes, they're voters, and so there's an eye to it. You don't want to go where the Brody went, the representatives, and call them thugs. People pull back from that very quickly. Republicans did, because they realize it's a movement too across the country, where we've seen in other right to work states, teachers marching. Of course, this being North Carolina, it was one day; they weren't going to disrupt it.
You find it, Craig Horn kind of distanced himself from his colleague's thug comment, but where does that mindset come from? Just because people are exercising their right to explain themselves and their plight with their elected representatives, why does that make them thugs?
So there's a little context here. What he was talking about, he was referring to them as union thugs. And one of the big pushbacks from the Republicans this week in the run-up to the protest was, this is a union movement. These guys, the North Carolina Association of Educators, is really just a union, and union. And that word is a bad word to Republicans, and it's something that teachers can't do in this state. They can't organize a union. The North Carolina Association of Educators does not have any kind of collective bargaining rights under state law. But when you invoke the idea of a union, it gets people's dander up. And I think that's what Representative Brody was talking about there. And he was pushing back as hard as he could, like the Republican leadership were. Now, union is not such a bad word to a lot of the teachers. I mean, you know, as we said before, we heard teachers talking about how they felt like they were building some strength here. So they're not going to get a union out of it. The question is whether they will get anywhere near the support that they want.
Well, it's not just the union connotation. I think for a lot of Republicans, the NCAA is an arm of the Democratic Party. The NCAA has supported Democrats for years and years. And frankly, a lot of the teachers are inclined to vote for Democrats, I think. Although I did meet somebody up there from Mecklenburg County who she and her husband were registered Republicans, and they said this is not a partisan issue, it's a policy issue.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, because they did get a lot of support. They do get a lot of support from Democrats, teachers do. And the governor, who is a Democrat, greeted them with a speech, I guess, on the Mall, where he really praised the effort they were putting into this march and coming to Raleigh and addressing their concerns with the legislature. Will that paint them with a partisan brush that they didn't need or intend?
Well, I think they are painted with that brush by a lot of Republicans in the legislature.
Whether Cooper spoke to them or not. And you talked with them, and their issues are very specific, not just pay. I've talked to some teachers who say, if I put a lot of money and time and effort into getting these advanced degrees, I want that to be reflected. Many of them love North Carolina, feel they can move other places and get more. So you do get a sense that these, if you're a teacher, you're dedicated and you just are wanting to be heard. That's a big piece of it.
Another sign I saw out there, I just graduated with my master's degree and all I got was this sign. So, and that's referring to the fact that the Republicans have done away with the bump up in pay that you get if you have an advanced degree.
Well, you did spend time talking to some teachers when you were up there, didn't you, David?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So what kind of anecdotal things were they telling you about their lives, about what they had to do to survive, about things they were buying for their classrooms that really should be paid for by the
state? I heard people complaining about how much they spend on supplies. One woman told me that she's lost track of all the receipts for doing that, and it's hard to there's no way to get it back. You know, I guess they can probably deduct that on their taxes or something, but you know, I think they would like to not have to spend that themselves. Another issue for some of these people who went to the rally was what they had to go through in order to get there. So if you were from a school system that didn't cancel classes, I talked to people from Randolph County, they had to get permission from their principals, they had to arrange for their own subs, and they had to pay $50 towards the cost of the sub for that day. This one person from an elementary school there said, four people from her school were able to get subs to go. That was it. They went through a list of 75 subs, and that's all they could get.
When you close schools, that causes parents problems because they have to arrange for daycare, particularly if you have two working parents, and they depend on the schools to take those kids for a certain part of the day. So when CMS closed schools, were there any complaints at all that we know about from parents?
I'm sure some parents were inconvenienced, although I did talk to a teacher up there who said that who drove up there and a parent had paid for her gas. The parent offered to do something. The parent said, you shouldn't have to pay for your own advocacy.
Wow.
And I know some local organizations did step up. I believe the Y accepted folks to come in and fed them and did some daycare. So there was some support in the community.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Okay. I was just saying up in Cabarrus County, they actually had a bus going around to different neighborhoods to feed kids.
Wow. Yeah, because some kids get their one big meal from the schools. I'm just curious about your thoughts about this. We hear these calls around the country now from teachers wanting more money and more respect, and there's a lot being asked of teachers. We're hearing police and fire in Charlotte and other places saying we need more money, we're not getting paid enough, we can't live in the cities in which we work, et cetera, et cetera. We heard in the last presidential campaign, we witnessed the anger of a lot of formerly middle-class people who feel the middle class slipping from their grasp. Are these rallies by teachers the beginning of something that's going to break the shell open on this? Is the middle class mad as hell and they're not going to take it anymore?
I think it's a sign of public employees feeling like they're embattled. I mean, let's go back a little bit. This is not something new. I mean, a lot of these employees have either not seen raises or they've taken pay cuts since back around 2008 when we were in the recession and local governments were having a hard time funding this stuff. They want to get back where they were and then maybe get a little better position for themselves.
And I think it's also national. You have Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, who has never been to a public school or sent her kids to it. She talks about private charter schools, religious schools. She just visited a city, and she didn't visit public schools. She visited some religious-affiliated schools. And so there's a sense of that, too.
And that's
folks saying we are doing a good job.
And that's part of the reason that public schools feel under attack. Clayton Wilcox says, he said it on this program, that he thinks that this move toward charter schools and vouchers is an effort to kill off the public schools. It's a pretty strong statement. Okay, the Poor People's Campaign also marched in Raleigh this week. They beat the teachers by 2 days. They were there on Monday. North Carolina's Reverend William Barber, who started the Moral Monday campaign, is leading this. The Poor People's Campaign preceded the, as I said, teachers by 2 days, but they blocked traffic. The teachers, I don't believe, blocked traffic. Is that a wise way to get attention?
Mary? Well, they were cited. They weren't arrested this time with handcuffs on them because I think that was not a good image for the Moral Mondays movement. I believe that people think we do in our political discourse talk a lot about the middle class. Nobody talks about the poor and their needs. And a co-leader is William Barber, the Reverend Dr. William Barber, who brought a lot of disparate groups together for the Moral Mondays March. You had environmentalists, you had folks who were concerned about income inequality and voting rights. And this is basically retooling what was going on with Martin Luther King. He was shifting that focus as well when he was assassinated to the Poor People's Campaign. And this is a continuation. William Barber said, it's bigger than politics. It's about addressing the deeper moral malady that has affected America. So I believe that this is going to be 40 days of different action. And
around the country.
Around the country and capitals around the country. There's going to be a teach-in next week in Washington with featuring Marion Wright Edelman, the president of the Children's Defense Fund, who was a part of the 1968 campaign. So they want to move on all these issues and form a diverse coalition. And as people are slipping from the middle class into, some of them, poverty, mm-hmm. And he's bringing the moral component to it as well. He and the co-leader, and I think people will listen. But it's very difficult to get people to pay attention to issues of poverty. And as far as politicians are concerned, you're going to have to see a lot of action from the poor who are going to call people to account.
Well, some of the signs in that march in Raleigh featured slogans like, fight poverty, not the poor, got money for war but can't feed the poor, invest in people, not prisons, and systemic racism is immoral. The legislature was closed on Monday. They hadn't started their short session yet. Why did they choose Monday to march on Raleigh? It was empty.
Well, they were marching in all the cities. It was a court. The big, they had one in Washington as well, where William Barber's folk. This is going to be continuing. So this was just the start. And they started at the beginning of the week.
Okay.
And they'll be back.
Charlotte City Councilwoman Lawana Mayfield is back in the news just weeks after she ignited controversy by supporting a 9/11 conspiracy theory, which we won't go into again this morning. But in March, she also sent a tweet saying, being black in America under 45, meaning Donald Trump, has created homegrown terrorists wearing blue uniforms. And she recently read that tweet to reporters.
Being black in America under 45 has created homegrown terrorists wearing blue uniforms. Hashtag a reckoning is coming.
So this week, two Charlotte TV stations took notice of that tweet because some police officers who were asking counsel for a raise called that message inappropriate. And here is Lawana Mayfield's response.
They find an opinion offensive. When you do the research on how many black and brown men and women have lost their lives or been assaulted, then we can have this conversation.
It gets a little tricky here because she's right about that, and all you have to do is watch the news on television to understand where she's coming from. But I don't know that you can make the connection between what's going on with police around the country and African-American, particularly men, based on Donald Trump, because I think it well preceded Donald Trump into office. And secondly, according to the Washington Post's tracker of police shootings, whites accounted for the most fatal police shootings in 2017, 46%. So what has been the reaction of other city council members to LaWanna Mayfield's tweet and comments about that tweet?
We had an internet video yesterday from Tariq Bakari, the District 6 council member, said, I was thinking about not saying anything about this, but I'm going to say something. And he came out and said he thought it was inappropriate. You know, typically council members don't comment on each other's comments like this, but I think we're in a situation now where they feel they have
to. How long has she been a
council member? She's second
term. I think
this
is her third.
Third term.
Okay.
Or so.
Third, that's what I was thinking. And I'm thinking, okay, we haven't heard anything from her about these things before. What's going on in the zeitgeist that is provoking her to make these comments now, or comments like these?
I think she may be feeling a little more confident in her position as a council member right now and feels that she has a right to speak up.
But as you say, Mike, it is tricky because I believe even the police chief spoke about it, Kerr Putney, and actually he did. What folks felt is maybe she spoke with too broad a brush, because as you said, this is a problem. There's been a problem in this community as well. We've seen people take to the streets about the relationship between minorities and the communities they cover. In my hometown of Baltimore, we've seen it. And we've also seen police in Baltimore arrested for doing corrupt things. And it's a problem. But painting with too broad a brush, using the word terrorism, and bringing national politics into it, folks perhaps felt she, instead of, it was a monologue instead of starting a dialogue.
Yeah. So I also wanted to add, the timing of this was a bit interesting. So the tweet was originally made March 26th. So we're talking 2 months ago. This actual tweet was sent to our news channel and a couple of other news channels, specifically at a time when the city council is discussing raises for police officers. It also coincides with Police Week, Peace Officers Week. So the timing is interesting. I don't know if this was an effort to try and gain additional support for funding additional salaries for police officers. I spoke with one police officer I've known here for 15 years, really good guy. He's a lifetime officer who really is trying to, he got in it because he wants to protect the community. He says it's a dire situation right now. He says it doesn't matter if we get that 15% increase. The police officers just don't feel wanted right now.
Okay. Mary mentioned Kerr Putney, Chief Kerr Putney's response to this. I want people to hear what he had to say about this, because he was hot under the collar about this. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, along with David Borax from our newsroom at WFAE News, Mary C. Curtis, roll call columnist and contributor to WCCB-TV, among other things. Sean Flynn is managing editor of Spectrum News Charlotte, and Jim Morrill is a political reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Don't want to spend too much more time on the LaWanna Mayfield tweet, but CMPD Chief Kerr Putney did recently respond to it. He seemed highly offended by the content of her tweet, and he made no bones about it.
Whenever we're painted with a broad brush, it's offensive. We've been talking about officers who win medals of merit for putting their lives on the line. And then to be put in a category like that, it's hard to stomach. And there should always be community accountability. I might not be able to hold people accountable, but community can.
Interesting.
Also, he's trying to, at this point, also recruit police officers. We're short, and they're having the discussions over the pay raises and this kind of thing. He's probably thinking, well, that's not what I need to put on the poster for We Need You in Charlotte Mecklenburg.
Right.
You know, when an elected official makes a statement about a public policy issue like this, in the past, they were often careful and diplomatic, and they would say something conciliatory, but also make their point that they oppose something. And we're now in a time when people feel it's okay to use the most extreme language.
That ship has sailed. But from the top on down, let's face it.
Yep. unfortunately. Last week, City Manager Marcus Jones unveiled a proposed $2.6 billion budget for this next fiscal year the city operates on, and that will include a raise in taxes of about one penny per $100 value for a person's home. This week, during their budget workshop, City Council made some adjustments. They asked for more clarity on that budget, and particularly on the 6.5% raise for CMPD officers. What did they want to know, and what did they hear from Marcus Jones?
So they have taken in the budget. They're looking at it. I think it sounds like from their budget discussions that among the areas that they would like to work on is the public safety pay area. The 6.5% raise is short of the 15% that the police are asking for. There's also the second phase of raises for firefighters in Charlotte right now. I think they're getting another 1.5% this year. So there may be some sympathy among the council members for doing more in that area. I think there seems to be support for the one penny tax increase, which would be $25 on a $250,000 house per year. So,
but when you add in the stormwater fees and the water fees, it comes out to like $54 to $59.
Right.
Just so you know.
Anyway, I think there's...
Look at Mike putting context.
I'm counting. Every penny.
You know, if you remember, the council members, when the police came before the council members and Mayor Vi Lyle said, well, let's ask the city manager to take a look at this and tell us what he can do. They've gotten that back. We're in a period right now where they have a few weeks here to talk about whether they want to bump that up or not.
This council also wants to reevaluate the pay plan to better support firefighters. And for firefighters, it's more than just pay that this is about. It includes medical benefits for retirees. What is the council looking at here for this, for better clarification from Marcus Jones?
I think they just want to see if there's something else they can do there. Actually, not sure what he's going to come back with.
Because some firefighters spoke up at a public hearing about what they see as the unfairness of the difference between police and fire department raises.
This recommendation makes me feel as you place a greater value on a police officer's life than my own.
We're not asking to be the highest paid fire department in the country. We're asking for fair pay and benefits.
And police, you mentioned, are scheduled to get this 6.5% raise, while firefighters are scheduled to receive a 1.5% raise. It gets a little complicated. We had a representative of the Fraternal Order of Police on this program earlier this week, and off the air, because we ran out of time, he didn't get a chance to say this on the air, he said that part of this 6.5% increase that they're slated to get comes from money already earmarked for raises, and some of which they've already received, some of them. So it really works out to something around the area of 2 to 4% as opposed to 6.5%. And the firefighters have myriad concerns. Is the council going to be able to respond to all these needs and concerns?
Well, during the budget committee hearing they had earlier this week, they did. It did come up that maybe the property tax increase should be more of in the line with 3 cents as opposed to the 1 cent, which would give them an additional, I believe my math may be off, but about $19 million a year, which could fund some of these raises. You've definitely already had Ed Driggs, a Republican, who says, I don't even like the 1 cent. Now you're talking three.
Yeah.
So, you got a budget, and you got a lot of people who want to be paid more and probably rightfully deserve to be paid more, but you need to keep the property rate attractive enough to keep recruiting more companies who can then pay more money.
They had a public discussion about this week. What did the public have to say about all of this?
A lot of the speakers were speaking in favor of raises for public safety officers in general. There were a couple of folks who said they'd like to have 15%. And so I think that the ball is in the council's court right now to decide whether they want to try and push for more.
And Councilmember Loana Mayfield said that the city may have to. Was she the one that brought this up?
She did the
tax. Marcus Jones told me when he was on the program with the mayor that this 1% raise that we're going to go through now. We've had these gyrations in property tax increases over the last several years, up and down and up and down. He said that this 1% raise should keep us stable for years to come.
When he was laying out his budget for the council and for reporters earlier in the day, a couple weeks ago, you know, he sees this as an adjustment for the long haul, and he showed us a graph that shows a flat tax rate into the future, but we still get all the things that we need, and we can do the $50 million affordable housing bond and other things. But, he also asked the department heads to go in and look at their budgets again, and they pulled, you know, like $14 million out that doesn't really affect services at all. So his big thing is that he thinks that we can make an adjustment this year, and then we can have a stable budget going forward.
We also have to remember that we are at the end of an eight-year revaluation on your property cycle. Next year, the properties will be revalued. So, and they always talk about how they will make that revenue neutral, how they'll bring the property tax rate down to keep it, but it never actually adds up that way.
Such a pessimist.
Well, it's revenue.
Just been there before.
Neutral with respect to all of the existing property, but we are in a cycle of construction right now, and so every time a new house or a new building gets added, we get more tax revenue.
And Mecklenburg County has requested that the city help pay for the artificial turf at Memorial Stadium, at the newly renovated Memorial Stadium. The city's Economic Development Committee voted 3-1 to recommend that the city contribute up to $3 million in tourism tax revenues toward this work. Is this likely to get the full council's support? This is once again from the hotel motel and the beverage tax, restaurant beverage tax, right?
Yeah, that would be. I mean, I think they look at that as different than property tax expenditure. So
all right,
theoretically.
During that meeting, there was just lots of questions about where else are we going to spend this money, and we had the whole discussion about all the things in the pipeline. But it seems like it has the support of the majority of the council.
Okay, Charlotte's about to get its largest hotel, a 1,000-room project that planners say will attract more large events. It also needs taxpayer support. How much and why, David?
How much is it going to get? I'm not sure. They've set money aside for this, but they see this coming because they want the city to be able to compete for larger conventions. And there's this sense that Charlotte hasn't benefited in the way that it thought it would when it built the original convention center.
Is this a case of if they build it, more things will come, more visitors will come, more events will come?
That's the theory.
Michael Smith, CEO of Charlotte Center City Partner, says that this is one of those assets that you have to have to be able to compete. Without this asset, he says, we're losing a step. To whom?
We're losing a step to other cities that have built these. You know, it's an arms race, isn't it? I mean, it's just like the, you know, can you keep your football team here? What do you have to do for them? I think in the past, you know, they thought if they had a 700-room hotel, they would be okay. And that's why the city put some money behind the Westin back in 2003. Now we're still competing, and we're still not getting the conventions we think we should. So former city manager Ron Kimball made the argument the other day that we need to do this. And this was in the context of looking at all of these projects in the pipeline that are going to be paid for with tourism money.
Would this be up in time and open in time for the Republican convention should we get it?
This is not, they don't have a site. They don't have a plan. This is something they say we need.
All right. The private contractor building toll lanes on I-77 says revising or ending its contract will cost a lot more money than what's been discussed publicly. We know that the state will have to pay I-77 Mobility Partners and their owner, Centra, millions. They have a 50-year contract to operate these things. What figure is Javier Tamargo, who's the CEO, putting on canceling the deal?
Well, there's no negotiations going on right now. They're just looking at different kinds of numbers that put a value on this. There's the fair market value. What does that include? Centra and I-77 Mobility Partners, the contractors, are saying you got to include our future toll revenues and a profit on this. So $300 million to $600 million is the number that they're putting on it.
Just when you think you can get up in the morning and not hear about Cardinal Innovations, we find out that former CEO Richard Topping is now suing his former agency for libel and slander, and he wants his $1.7 million severance package back. What's going on here?
Well, he's already got his $1.7 million severance package.
Wants to keep
they're
it.
Trying to get it back. And I guess this was inevitable. You know, last we looked, Cardinal had an extraordinary news conference, an extraordinarily detailed news conference, where a former prosecutor laid out a case against Mr. Topping, who was the CEO. And this was Topping's response to that press conference.
Okay. And he's, they called these claims, Cardinal calls these claims meritless. The director of the Charlotte Symphony Orchestra is busy this weekend. Christopher Warren Green is in London to conduct the royal wedding. It's the third royal wedding he's conducted. You spoke with Green. He's big into the royal family.
Oh, he's really big into the...
he's got his fascinator, right?
He is one of the most fascinating people I've ever interviewed in the city of Charlotte. He spoke the other day about now having the, quote, hat trick of royal weddings. He's done several other royal events, so many he can't even remember. He took a red-eye flight the other day over, and he's like, the symphony's ready to go. I just have to make sure I don't screw it up.
Not many people know this, but he remains the conductor of the London Chamber Orchestra. Yes. He's never given that position up. And he said that this is going to have an American slant, this wedding. Is he going to change the music some way?
Oh, he said that's top secret, and he would kill me if he told me. Seriously.
Did he tell you?
No, I'm still here, Mike.
Uh-oh, we gotta get it out of him.
When we decided to do this last story, no one else had done it, but since that decision was made, it's been featured on lots of different news programs. Everybody's done it. But I'm talking about the internet meme that proves that we all have too much time on our hands. Is it Laurel or Yanni? It's a short piece of audio that has ignited arguments around the world. So what do you hear?
Laurel.
Now, when they played that for me yesterday, I clearly heard Laurel, along with two of our producers. The other two heard Yanny, which is, I think, but you all heard Yanny, right?
I heard both.
I heard Laurel.
I heard Yanny.
Did you hear Laurel?
Right then?
Okay. Well, the New York Times explained this. They put a demonstration on their website. It's all about frequency response in your headphones and maybe in your ears. And they have a little slider on their website. You can go back and forth and change the frequency response. If you do, here is what you hear.
Laurel. Laurel.
Now I'm changing the slide.
Laurel.
I'm moving it to the right.
Laurel. Yanny.
Here we go.
Yanny. Yanny. Yanny.
Now I'm moving it back to the left. Here we go.
Yanny. Laurel. Laurel. Laurel.
Laurel. What did you hear? Do you always hear Yanny?
I heard Laurel the entire time, but
really?
I might have bad hearing.
I heard both, one side and the other.
I heard both, but right. I hear both of them. But, you know, the singer Yanny said, of course, he tweeted out, of course it's Yanny.
Mike,
The moral of the story is to have good speakers.
We have not analyzed a piece of audio like this since the Beatles. Remember,
Paul is dead on Abbey Road?
We all played it backwards.
Wait
to see
a minute.
What we could hear.
We should play this backwards next week and see what we find.
Oh, no.
All right. David Borax from WFAE News, Jim Morrill, political reporter for the Charlotte Observer, Sean Flynn from Spectrum News, where he's the managing editor, and Mary C. Curtis, columnist for Roll Call. Thank you all, and thanks to Laurel, whoever she is, and to Yanny as well.